Before we can lead others, we need to be able to lead ourselves. It's as simple as that. The best leaders understand to set themselves apart, they need to do the inner work. And our guest today is going to walk us through 7 of the key skills required in self-mastery that you can learn to become a phenomenal leader. I'm Damon Lemby, the CEO of Learn It, and welcome to another episode of the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we know that being a great leader, you're not born or made, you're constantly in the making. I'm super excited to be joined today by Dr. Craig Dowden, a Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestselling author. His most recent book is A Time to Lead, Mastering Yourself So You Can Master Your World, co-written by the legendary former Ford CEO and Boeing CEO, Alan Mulally. Craig is also the host of Do Good to Lead Well, a top 1% leadership podcast, and he's a regular contributor to Forbes, CEO World, and many other publications. Craig is an award-winning keynote speaker known for helping leaders unlock their full potential. Some of the key areas that we discussed is positive leadership, and we talk about the 7 key traits from mindset to emotions, which are the foundations. And then we get into resilience, and I love the conversation around the difference between pressure and stress. And we finish it up talking about authentic leadership. And a special surprise bonus near the end is Craig gives literally a masterclass on how to be a great interviewer. You're not going to want to miss that part. Let's jump into this amazing conversation I have with Dr. Craig Dowden. What is positive leadership? And I would assume you'd say it's probably more important now than ever.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Positive leadership is more important now than ever before. People are looking for leadership today more than ever. It's always been important. And so to find a compelling and inspiring vision for a positive future, that's where people are looking. And you look around the world these days and what's happening, there's discouraging news around almost every corner. And so finding that light to gravitate towards, and I remember having Kim Cameron, he's the co-founder of the Center for Positive Organizational Scholarship at the University of Michigan, and he talked about how as human beings, we're attracted towards the positive, we're attracted towards light, and that is a life-giving, life-enhancing force, and I just love that. And so having that positive vision for the future is critical, and my view on positive leadership is where we're really, it's a bigger than self goal. What intrinsically is motivating us is to have a positive impact on ourselves, on our teams, on our organizations, on our families, on our community. How do we contribute to moving things forward in a positive way? And I think, and there's so much evidence supporting this, that when we can look at it in that much broader way, when we look at ourselves as part of a broader ecosystem, all of us benefit from that. We achieve more than you could ever possibly imagine individually because we have that orientation for let's be a part of something big and let's inspire each other. And then others around us accomplish so much more. So it is such an important piece.
And I think you've shared that studies have shown that it's not just a nice to have, that actual organizations and leaders are much more effective when they take this approach.
Yes, and that's what was essentially the primary reason I wrote my first book, Do Good to Lead Well, because it was almost seen as competing forces. I can either drive results, and then I basically have to just step on people and drive them into the ground to get there, or I can be a heavily focused people leader, and then my results are necessarily suboptimal. And I love that when you look at the research, both, they go hand in hand. They're not competing forces. So when I focus on getting the best out of the teams, the organization that I'm a part of, well, that drives great results. I can be empathetic and hold people accountable. And we've talked about before you started, Doug Conant, former CEO of Campbell Soup, and he has this amazing idea around the power of the and. It's not an either or, it's an and. How can I be a positive people leader and drive positive organizational performance? We're not sacrificing one for the other.
Can you give us a quick example of what positive leadership could look like in an organization?
I would say positive leadership in an organization is when people are clearly rallied around a common purpose, where they see that everybody around the table has a valuable piece of input for the puzzle, and that we are aspiring to be the best version of ourselves. And so we talk about and we have difficult conversations. We discuss the type of impact that we want to have in an organization, individually and collectively. We're very clear about the path forward and how the work that we do benefits ourselves, our communities, our families. All of those elements are intertwined in terms of creating a positive organizational culture and experience.
And you know this as well as I do. The younger generations, they're demanding that. You know, it's got to be more than, I talked about this with Dan Turner, who you work with, who's awesome, right? It's got to be more than just about profits. They want the purpose too, to go with it and get everybody, if you can get your team members aligned with their, what their aspirations are and your company goal, and you get everybody behind that, that's where the magic happens, really.
You're absolutely right. Because I mean, we get to every morning, we decide what we're going to do and who we're going to do it with. And so if we're part of an organization or team where you go, oh, okay, it just seems like it's all about the leader. Like it's all about Craig all day, every day. It doesn't seem like we matter as the team. It doesn't seem like our customers matter. It doesn't seem like our communities matter. Well, now that very streamlined and singular focus is not really that engaging. It is not positive. Doesn't feel good to be a part of that. So now I step back and say, wow, well, so now I have a leader who is very clear about our why. And we've co-created that why. I'm clear on my sense of purpose. And every day I have the opportunity to do meaningful work, and the connection between what I'm doing and the reason why we're all together is not only continually highlighted, it's awarded and recognized. So you just compare and contrast even briefly those two situations, and we can see so quickly. And you talk about Dan Turner, an extraordinary chief executive, multiple award-winning organization for phenomenal culture. That's at the heart of their success.
Absolutely. And that's when, you know, for our listeners out there, that's when people come to work for more than the paycheck. You know, they're excited, they're looking forward to it because they really believe that they're part of something and they're making a difference. Let's switch gears now. I want to talk about your latest book, A Time to Lead, Mastering Yourself So You Could Master the World. I loved it. I read the whole thing over the last 4 days. And what I liked about it, and you and I talked about this on your show with my book, is there's the being and doing and how you have everything broken down into these seven key skills. But I want you to share a little bit, like, what was the big idea behind it? And yeah, what inspired you to write this?
Well, thank you. And I have to say, and I have my copy of your book here. So
oh.
everybody could see. As soon as I opened it, it was awesome. I was like, being
you're too much.
I said, come on, Damon. Like, this is just great.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the question. And for me, it really was germinated at the beginning of the pandemic. And I, having conversations with the clients that I work with, the CEO mastermind forums that I facilitate, there was a recurring question that people would continually ask is that, how are we going to get out of it? Like, what is the path forward? And then when you went a little bit deeper into that question, it was more personal. It's like, how am I going to get out of it?
Right.
And so that became the rallying cry for me, and then really organized around the key idea of great leadership starts with great self-leadership. And so I'd written my first book, Do Good to Lead Well. It was about self-leadership. A broader piece of it was, so how do we engage the people around us? And so what I wanted to do, and the timing in which this happened, was say, okay, so what are those core personal qualities? What are those core skills that are essential for us to navigate both today as well as the challenges and opportunities of tomorrow? And then when that idea took hold, it really inspired me to dig deep into the research and then look at how to link that research with practice.
And what I love about that is you refer to them as skills, which I believe means that they can be developed. right? So it's not either nature or nurture that they can be developed. And your book, well, and also the structure of your book, which I love, is you have it broken down into the seven skills, and we can kind of go through those. But also, you worked with a wonderful individual, let you share about that, and you turned it into a masterclass for each chapter. So not only are you talking about the skills and how-tos, but then you tie it to a case study or something that, you know, a story that it helps you really understand.
Well, and thank you. And it was such a fortuitous, serendipitous turn where I had the opportunity to meet with Alan Mulally, the former CEO of Ford, and Boeing, and yeah. President of Boeing. And we struck up this conversation. And one of the things that we aligned on very, very quickly was, okay, how do we turn this into practice? And I wanted to, in each chapter, so I had that framework in mind, what I wanted to do was say, okay, so how can we live and lead these practices? Because the research is important and powerful. And then to your point about the skills, well, how can we build and develop the skills that we need? And so with Alan, in every single chapter, what we did was I would ask him about mastering our emotions, mastering our mindset, things that are deeply embedded in your book, right? And say, so how did these things come to life at Ford? Alan created the Working Together Management System, which the name itself is so powerful and inspiring. And what we did in each of the chapters was identify how those core qualities and skills came to life within Ford, and how he's one of the most widely respected and successful CEOs of all time. He engineered a remarkable turnaround at Ford. When he joined, I think the stock price was about a dollar, and when he left, it was $18.26. He was just unheard of what he was able to do. And he did this through these core principles and practices of working together, which mesh so beautifully within the framework of A Time to Lead.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing experience for you. And so to kick it off, the two fundamental, foundational, so to speak, are mindset and emotions, mastering your mindset and emotions. Let's start off with, talk to me a little bit about mindset.
Mindset was an intentional choice and foundational, and this is where so many things that we have shared passions around. Is that with mindset, that sets the foundation. So how we look at a particular situation, how we view things, the way in which we interpret the conversations that we have or the experiences that we're a part of, that's critical. And in particular, you talked about skill. Mastering our mindset is a skill that we can learn. And so drawing heavily on the work of Carol Dweck, Growth Versus Fixed Mindset, learn it all. That's an example, right? I'm approaching a situation about what I can learn as opposed to telling someone where they're wrong or how I can one-up myself by, again, using my status or using my experience. No, I'm going into every situation with an open mind to see what I can learn, how I can test my assumptions. So I really wanted to start there because the mindset that we have before we even begin a conversation is an example, one of the skills I talk about later. I say how a conversation starts is how a conversation ends. The mindset that we have just really sets the table or not for what's going to happen next. And then intimately intertwined with that is our emotional world, which are incredibly powerful data. And even though we experience ourselves every single day, the relationship we have with our emotions may or may not be as aware and prevalent and present in our day-to-day reflections. And so I really wanted to right away set the table for people around, hey, what's your mindset? And be mindful of your mindset. And then also, how much time, attention, effort, energy do you put into understanding, better understanding your emotional world? And the evidence is abundantly clear that when we're mindful of our mindset and mindful of our emotions, then it maximizes the chances we'll have a positive impact on ourselves and the people around.
Absolutely. And if you look at it, you know, you have the growth mindset, you have a fixed mindset, you could say learn it mindset, whatever you want, but people flow in and out of those. So it's important to be self-aware of where you're at, right? Because nobody is just strictly growth mindset all the time. So you have to catch yourself and make sure that you're not in that really fixed state of mind.
And it's a great insight that you're sharing, Damon, because we can fall into that trap, a fixed mindset idea that, oh, well, I'm a growth mindset person. And now almost lose sight of, you know what, there are going to be some conversations and some people that may prompt us to go and fix, like, I know what's going to happen, or start to judge right out of the gate. And I think it's absolutely essential for us to recognize that. And as you say, there are going to be situations and times when I'm all about learn it all, and there are going to be times where I've learned enough and I'm, you know, I'm tapping out on this. And I think what's interesting as well, let's link it to emotions. There's been a big focus on, and we talked about this before going live, around that positivity. We talked about positive leadership at the beginning. And positive emotions, having a positive impact, positive energy, all really, really great. And there's a compelling and growing body of research around toxic positivity, which is it has to be positive. And I think what's a really critical insight for all of us to reflect on is that negative emotions are part of a learn-it-all mentality. We want to learn it all from the positive emotions. So what's going on that's creating these positive feelings within us right now? Where we can run into trouble is, oh, I'm feeling a negative emotion, sadness, frustration, anger, and then almost try to bury it rather than go, this is still an equally valuable moment for me to learn. I still want to understand what's underneath this, because otherwise, how do I pivot and learn from this emotion and now channel it to have the impact that I'm looking to have? Because it's trying to teach me a lesson as well.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. You can't be positive all the time. You know, there's just no way. And it's okay to allow yourself, listeners, to kind of sit back and absorb those negative feelings. And then I know, like you like to say, yeah, and even label them, and not so broad, but like, what is this negative emotion I'm having? Is it I'm just upset, or is it I'm annoyed, right? So to be able to, when you do that, because then you can really address what's going on.
Absolutely. So, you know, I saying I feel terrible. Okay, well, there's so many reasons why we could feel terrible. I feel lonely. Where I feel disconnected. Okay, so now the follow-up, the learned question is, okay, so what's behind that feeling of loneliness? And now we start to understand and gather knowledge, right? We're learning. And what I love about that is the more specific we are, and there's so much research that supports this, the more effective and specific we are at labeling our emotions, the more that we process them more effectively, that we move through them more efficiently, and we can take positive action. And so now, because I'm labeling that emotion as, oh, well, I'm feeling lonely, well, now I can reach out to a friend of mine. I can give Damon a call. I can go on my Facebook group, or go in where, once again, there's a sense of community. This empowers us to now learn from our situation and build an action plan, which is also incredibly important.
Oh, absolutely. And great leaders, I don't really think you can be effective if you can't control your emotions. If you let it trigger you and get out of hand, because people aren't going to want to follow that if there's somebody who's volatile, and you just lose a lot of trust in doing so.
Well, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because sometimes, and once again, linking it back to my motivation for my first book, sometimes the popular media portrayals of leaders, right, that volatile, really aggressive, angry, you know, tear people down. And what's interesting is that's great media. It can be great media. You look at the evidence around that, that's not sustainable. And leaders who follow that philosophy are not as effective. And here's the other thing, which I think is such an interesting question that so often gets overlooked. There's this automatic assumption that abrasive, aggressive style is what led to their success. I think in some of the more thoughtful discussions that I've been a part of is that, imagine if they adopted a different approach. What more could they have achieved? Why, to your point, Damon, mastering their emotions, be more in tune with their emotions more effectively. And you can see so many examples of even those individuals, highly media publicized individuals, where it's, wow, that response completely undermined their ability to achieve something in this situation. So it's not, it's funny how we run to, well, this caused X versus going, imagine what could have happened if they had done what.
Well, I mean, we don't even need to talk about it too much, but you see very clearly, even it people who lose their emotions and they go off the rails, right? And they just lose any credibility that happens with it. Before we move on too much, one story that I really enjoyed in your book, and this goes back to mindset. We hear a lot about Blockbuster and Kodak and how they failed. But one story, Craig, that I was less familiar with, which I love, was your New York Times story. Can you share a little bit about that, but especially around the questions that they asked themselves? Because I think that that is really important for organizations, for listeners out there. If your organization is stale or struggling, this is a great case study.
Well, thank you. And it is, it's an amazing, and I had the privilege of speaking with Adam Bryant, who used to write the corner office columns for the New York Times. And as in the case across the broader media landscape, they were struggling. So subscription revenue going down and down and down and down. And so what are we going to do? And there was kind of this disconnection between the newsroom and the sales side and all of that. And so what opportunities do we have? And what I love, getting back to the question that you asked, is that they really stepped back and had the courage to say, okay, who do we need to be? What do we need to do? What opportunities exist? Where can we take this as an organization? And rather than being really aligned and stuck, almost anchored to the past, it was, so how do we create a positive future? And once they shifted that and looked at the digital landscape and how can we expand and what do our readers really need, and letting go of some of the old assumptions and operating principles that they had, they were able to transform themselves and continue on the journey that, once again, they had been the hallmark for so long. And to your point, there are so many other examples of organizations that fell victim to that. Well, our old success is eventually going to lead us to where they need to go. And with their CEO and senior leadership team, they're like, hey, let's reimagine where we are right now.
Yeah, because if you just keep your head in the sand, you're done. And what I hear you saying is that a lot of it probably has to do with the ego in that situation, right? So it's like, we've been around 170 years, we're the greatest, you know, we're always going to be that way. What practical advice do you have for our listeners for how do you get yourself unstuck in a situation like that?
It's an awesome question. I love that you're linking ego to this, because this is it, right? I mean, and coming back to learn it all.
I love it.
To know it all. Again, let's leave. That's ego. Just blare on 10 plus, right? I know it all. I know it all. And it feels good to know it all. Like if I don't, right? So that's very ego serving. We can just get so stuck in that. And I had the privilege to speak with Bryce Hoffman, who also wrote a book about Alan Mulally, and has done a lot of work on red team thinking and red teaming. And one of the best questions, and he shared with me, that I think helps us get unstuck is, what are the comforting lies we're telling ourselves right now? I'm loving that, because that's a really uncomfortable question to ask, because then you got to go, yeah, okay, Demon, like, I think we're really betting big on that eventually subscriptions will come back. And this whole digital thing is not going to work out. Like, people are going to eventually, that's a fad. And so I think by framing the question in that way, what are the comforting lies? Because that helps orient and frame the question. Because once again, to raise that self-awareness, there are things we may be thinking of right now, and then we just rationalize. We all have this amazing ability to do it. So asking ourselves that question, it's a fabulous way to go, all right, here's what's going on. And I think another way, and some of my clients have done this as well, which I think is also very powerful, is to say, what from the past do we want to continue to move forward? And what from the past is important for us or necessary for us to let go? Because sometimes, again, going back to your astute observation at the beginning about this kind of competing side. And then we can run the risk of almost really undermining our legacy or where we've been up to this point. So I think it's critical to say, what do we bring forward? Because it honors the past. And then it also says, hey, how can we embrace the future? And they're not competing.
No, absolutely. And what I hear you saying too, and this is one of the key skills in your book, is if you're asking the questions, you got to be ready to receive the feedback as well. Yeah,
absolutely. I like to say to people, you know, never ask a question you're not ready for the answer. Or if I ask you a question and then you get upset or you give me an answer that I don't like, then I can't be, well, David, blah, 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 blah. I've asked the question. So now I have to take responsibility for that. And you highlighting the feedback, again, back to learn it all, that's essential. We must open ourselves to feedback. Back to skills, we must ask for feedback on a regular basis, because otherwise I'm going to have my idea of how things went. And I continually ask guests on my podcasts, coaching clients of mine, speaking clients, what worked well, what didn't work well, what could I do to improve, what other things could I have spoken about or not in this presentation? All of this allows us to maximize our impact. So we have to keep asking questions.
Absolutely. I think feedback, receiving feedback, is like rocket fuel for learning, right? I mean, you can't grow and evolve if you're not open to accepting feedback. And it's interesting, because there's a lot in your book, you talk about only receiving feedback, right? I mean, there's a lot of work always on how to give feedback. Why did you choose to focus strictly, I don't say strictly, but, you know, mainly on receiving feedback?
Oh, and thank you. And I really appreciate the question, and you nailed it. You opened the door for it, right? If you go and Google feedback, if you look at the courses available, the books written, YouTube videos, the vast majority are about, well, how can I give the best quality feedback to Damon to maximize the chances Damon will listen to it? Which, okay, fair enough. Yet what's really interesting, and back to great leadership starts with great self-leadership, what's the best way to maximize the chances someone will listen to my feedback? Maybe I can ask them for feedback first. Maybe I can model how to receive feedback so as a leader of a team, they can follow my lead. And so there's just such tremendous potential. And one of my favorite studies, and there are over 30,000, if not over 35,000 people, leaders who are part of this, 81% of the top leaders were highly skilled in giving and receiving feedback. And so often we get focused on, well, how do I give feedback more effectively? It's how I receive feedback opens it up so that I can learn the most about myself. And it also provides a tremendous opportunity for me to model the very behaviors that I'm open to see in the people around me.
And I think you have another study that shows that most individuals would rather receive feedback than give feedback.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because when you ask people, hey, do you want to give feedback? It's like, I'm not really sure. When you ask people, would you like to receive feedback? The vast majority of people say yes. And it's funny, I'll do this in workshops that I facilitate. And sometimes with audiences, I'll say, okay, on a scale of 0 to 10, rate your motivation to receive feedback. How willing are you to receive feedback? And then I'll say, hey, so for everyone else in this room, your colleagues, how motivated are they to receive? And it's a fascinating disconnect, because they usually rate themselves 7 or 8 that I want it. And then if I rate my colleagues, it's 3 or 4. And it's such an interesting kind of example of the self-serving bias. And then also ways in which, well, now we're holding ourselves back from giving the feedback that we want others to give us. And a lot of times it comes down to, well, what kind of feedback does Damon want? How can I give it to him in a way that's going to open up, so it's going to be a learning conversation as opposed to a defensive conversation? So then the secret sauce around that, let's let everybody know how I want to receive feedback, what kind of feedback that I want, and the conditions under which I want to receive that. Awesome. So now I can be in control of answering those questions. Now that eliminates or certainly minimizes a barrier to you giving me feedback.
No, I love it. And that's one of the questions I had for you is as a leader, because a lot of times, you know, people, your employees, even if you're, you know, come across as trustworthy, they're shy when it comes to giving feedback to a leader. So how do you go about asking for feedback? What are some good feedback prompting questions, so to speak?
Yeah, I think so. A couple of things. Number one, start with why. Explain why your feedback, getting feedback, is important. And so, and I'll coach my executives to share, hey, in order for me to be at my best and have the best positive impact on you and on the team, I need your feedback because I have blind spots. And so you're an invaluable source of feedback for me. And without your input, I can't be at my best. And so I'd love for you to, when I'm doing something well, let me know. When I'm not, let me know. And I'm going to keep checking in with you. I'm asking for feedback is going to be a regular part of our conversation. And here's the type of feedback that I'm looking for. And here's the best way to frame it for me. And what an awesome, once again, it eliminates all of the gee, I wonder if or how. Now, some leaders I work with, they'll say, well, Craig, I asked for feedback and I didn't get anything back. And I'll say, okay, give me some examples of questions. Well, I'll say, how did that meeting go? Or is everything okay? And then I go, well, guess what? Most people are going to say it's fine or or no, it's all good. So one of the really cool Jedi tricks when it comes to feedback is the more specific we can be, the better it is. So I'll give you a great example. Dave, and I wonder sometimes in meetings that I cut people off or I've cut someone off before they finish their point. Like, what are your thoughts on that? How can I approach that better? A couple of really powerful signals there. Number one, wow, it's a very specific question. So it's a lot tougher to be like, you know, oh, it's fine, it's fine. And by giving that specific example, it shows the other person, gee, I'm wondering about it, and I really could use your input on this. So it signals a level of self-awareness. So now it's, yeah, you know what? Sometimes I have noticed da-da-da-da-da. So because one of the barriers to giving feedback is I'm worried, well, what if this is something you don't want feedback on? So now I'm telling you, yeah, this is something I'm looking for.
No, I love it. And I actually learned that Jedi trick in Adam Grant's book, Think Again, I believe it was. And I used it. My example from that, Craig, is when I was writing my book, I shared it with a couple people, not too many, but a couple people. And there were a target audience. And I'd say, hey, can you look over chapter one for me or chapter two for me? I really don't think that this specific session is any good. And what it did is it opened the door for these individuals to say, okay, I see what Damon's asking for, but also that he is receptive to feedback, and it makes it so much better, right?
Absolutely, because it's showing you, hey, well, how's this going to, you're part of my target audience, how's it landing? And then also, why are you framing the question in that way? I want feedback. I want this to be the best quality book that I can. I want the content to resonate with people. And I did the same thing around, so I followed your lead on that, right? In terms of, well, tell me how this is landing with you. What else? What other ideas could I put in there? Is there something that might not be clear in terms of its application? So, and I'm counting on you, and I'd rather you tell me that than a reader write a review or come back and say, hey, well, this didn't really make sense. So please, you know, be my trusted confidant and feedback provider.
I think it's so critical. Here's a question that somebody asked me the other day. What do you do, Craig, when the feedback that somebody gives you is just flat out wrong, not true?
I think that's great. So, I mean, not great that you think it's flat out wrong. It is a great question because, well, what do you do with that? So a couple of things. Ask for clarification. So can you give me some examples? Because one of the things I find sometimes is that people use labels and we react to the behavior, the label, rather than the example. And so by asking them, hey, can you give me some examples of this? If it's a label-based criticism, that's one thing. If it's something that I categorically disagree with, and let's say that there are examples that they provide that, well, thank you for sharing with me. I appreciate that you feel safe to be able to let me know. And let's say you have no, and this is a team environment, and you say, I'm not sure I agree with you on that. And I'm still grateful that we had this conversation. And if things come up, I want you to continually share with me, because I'm not saying you're wrong and I'm right. I'd love to continue to learn. Just right now, I'm not on the same page.
Right. And I think one of the things you said in there that's really key, I want to make sure our listeners know, is that when somebody gives you feedback, you should always say thank you.
Yes. Absolutely. And back to the positivity, and we were talking about earlier, toxic positivity. Thanking someone for positive feedback is just as valid for negative. We might not like it. The taste may not be as good for us. Yet, well, thank you. Someone has taken the time out of their day and had the courage to share that with us. So thanking them is a really powerful technique that we often don't use nearly enough, because also as well, well, guess what can happen? If we don't thank people for it, our feedback, well, can dry up very, very fast.
Well, not only that, but it will dry up really, really fast as well if you don't ever take action on any of the feedback you get.
Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. And here's what's also really interesting, and I love the example that you just provided here, is that if we receive feedback and we don't do anything with it, the evidence shows us this is one of the worst things that we can do. It drives disengagement, because what's the point? And how many organizations do I work with, when they do engagement surveys, people say, yeah, I'm not even bothering because no one does anything with this anyhow. Now, what also, which I think is a nuance, which is lost in the last example, what we just talked about is a great illustration of this, is we don't have to do all the feedback we've received. Like, hey, here are six things that have come out of our engagement survey or a personal leadership 360. And then I can share all six of them and say, hey, I'm going to do these three in the next 6-12 months. So I'm still taking action by validating the feedback that I've received and then saying, well, now what I'm going to do is focus on these areas. And that is incredibly powerful.
I think what you're saying there is you're communicating, right? So it's not somebody's given you, they've taken the time, and especially if it's somebody who reports to you, is putting their neck out there, you know, giving you this information that might have been tough for them. And instead of it going into a black hole, you're communicating with them that you've received it and what you plan to do with it. And it may be nothing, it may be something, but I think that's so important. And it's incredibly important to have a culture and an environment where people can continue to give feedback. And that's how you model that behavior, I believe, as a leader, to communicate with them and give them examples of how you've implemented it. I've, for instance, when I first started doing public speaking, I'm really fortunate. I have a great guy on our team, Darren Bridget, and he'd always give me feedback. And whether it would be get done doing a podcast or a keynote or whatever, I'd always come back to him and share with him where I implemented it and would thank him again for it. And I just think it goes a long way.
For sure. Absolutely. And I think, and it demonstrates that we care about it. It demonstrates that it matters to us. And you use the magic word, communication. Because communication is an action. And a lot of times, even let's say there's competing feedback. Let's start the meetings earlier. Let's start the meetings later. And there, I don't know. And this is where, once again, closing that feedback loop. I've decided to do this. Thanks for the feedback from all of you. And here's where we're going to go in the future. To your point, Damon, hey, here are the things I'm going to action. Here are the things I'm going to put in the parking lot. Here are the things that I'm not going to do right now at this moment. Still open to reconsidering it. That is action. It's closing the loop on the feedback. It's honoring it, even if it isn't put into practice immediately or ever. And that's important to people, the acknowledgement side.
So moving on, one of the key skills that I think is so critical, and something that I'd like to think is a strength of mine, is let's talk a little bit about resilience. So first of all, how would you define resilience?
So I would define resilience as the ability to bounce back from challenging events or setbacks to quote unquote baseline. So how quickly do we recover when things don't work out? And in this environment where things are moving so, so quickly, there are going to be lots of challenges and unexpected events that occur on a daily basis. So that's at the heart of resilience.
And one of the pieces I thought was really fascinating is the difference between pressure and stress.
Well, and I thank you. It's one of the things that I loved. I was so excited to write about it in the book, the Center for Creative Leadership. And I think they've just done a masterful job of this, whereby they define pressure as the extent of the demands that our external environment places on us. So I'll say that again, because I think it's great. Pressure represents the extent of the demands that our external environment places on us. Stress is our internal belief about our ability to deal with those demands. And I love that, because what it does is show us that pressure is external, stress is internal. It also shows us why, and I think it's brilliant when we think about it, people say, oh, well, two people in the same situation have an entirely different stress response, even if they look, quote unquote, the same. What's happening is one person feels, hey, I've got this, and then the other person feels overwhelmed by the pressure. And what I also love about that distinction, because it aligns so beautifully with the research around stress and resiliency, is that, well, there's a resource-based element to this. In one situation, the person who is thriving or certainly surviving through that period feel they have adequate resources to be able to navigate this. When someone feels stress, I don't have sufficient resources to deal with the pressure I'm under. Which now, as you can probably reflect on, the photo negative of that is, now how do I go about acquiring the resources I need to raise my confidence that I can deal with the pressure? Again, back to learning mindset, back to skills, back to being aware. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot to deal with mindset. I have two individuals in my lifetime who are close to me. And when I heard this about stress, you know, two people could look at it completely different. I looked at those two individuals. One just he just found out ways to get it done, and he just handled it. It didn't bother him. The other one, unfortunately, I think it led to an early death, cancer and everything. And in your book, you talk about how there's studies that show that if you're not able to deal with stress, that could hurt your lifespan.
Well, and to build on that, and appreciate you sharing that personal example. One of my favorite studies in this space was where they looked at people's stress beliefs, right? Like mindset about stress. And so they wanted to do an examination of the link between stress and early mortality. And not surprisingly, they found higher stress levels are the risk of early mortality. They went a little deeper and looked at the stress beliefs of the people. They found that relationship between stress and early mortality risk only existed for people who believed that stress was harmful to them. Those who view stress as natural, as a part of our lives, it signals things that we care about. There was no relationship whatsoever. Kelly McGonigal talks about this in an amazing TED Talk and a book called The Upside of Stress. New York Times, Wall Street Journal have written all about this research. And so it's really interesting, and I get people I work with, and in when I deliver keynotes, I'll ask the audience, what's your relationship with stress? What is your mindset around stress, and how might that impact your psychological, emotional, and physiological well-being? Because those things are intimately intertwined.
I think that's so important. And this comes back to the self-mastery. And it's like, do you look at stress? And I would assume that the people who just accept it and don't want to do anything about it are the ones with the victim mentality a lot of times, right? You know, going back to chapter one with mindset is, do you look at everything as a opportunity or a challenge or a problem, right? And it's how you frame things. And then the stress will really build up for the ones who always look at it as a negative perspective all the time.
Absolutely, because if I have the belief that stress is harmful, stress can kill me, right? Well, what's the first thing I'm going to do? as soon as I start to feel stressed, I'm going to try to avoid it. Right? This is bad, bad, bad. So I'm going to engage in maladaptive coping mechanisms like procrastination, right? Drinking as another example. So on and on, I'm not dealing with the root cause. And so stress fundamentally, I say, is our mind, our body, our heart's way of letting us know something's up. Please pay attention to me. And just like in medical intervention, right? What's the first thing they say all the time? Early intervention is key. So by avoiding it, it doesn't go away. So let's pay attention. Let's learn what it's trying to tell us. And then we move from that and say, okay, I accept it. The reason I'm feeling this right now is I care about something. This is important for me to look at. It's a natural part of life. It's there. It's activation energy for me. And now with that awareness, I can move into, well, with this feeling, how do I commit to using this in a positive way to address what I'm feeling right now? Because if that stress is there, I've been delaying, having this difficult conversation with my client, my spouse, a family member, or I'm behind on this file and I need to get to, all right, that's what it's there for. It's your early warning signal. So now you've got that energy at your disposal. How are we going to deploy it?
I think one tip that you have in your book that our listeners can go out and apply immediately around stress is this silent mantras.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think having mantras, which is, it's completely natural to feel this way, right? I am not defined by my stress. This too shall pass. Whatever those mantras are that you can have are incredibly important for you in terms of, once again, in those moments of stress, how can I anchor myself? Just had a coaching conversation yesterday with someone who said, I am playing my biggest positive leadership role in a new world. That was the mantra. And then in every situation now, that becomes a reflection point for them around, so how do I need to show up here? Reflecting on that mantra. So, so powerful.
And it's something really simple that you can do. You could say it to yourself, and it's something that gets you, I think, in a different and a more positive mindset.
Absolutely. And it does, and you use the word positive mindset, shifting your mindset. Because now with that mantra, when we're caught up in that stressful emotion and we can start to feel overwhelmed, it's like, okay, let's get back to baseline. Those mantras can be incredibly powerful for us to go, yes, okay, here's where I am. I'm feeling more centered now. So what am I learning from this? Once again, how am I going to take this learning and put it into practice?
Well, hello, listeners. Damon and Craig here. Now, you may notice that we had an intermission, took a little break, right, Craig?
Yeah, exactly. I hope I'm the first. This is the plan, right, to be the first guest that has a costume change between episode one and episode two. So, yeah, this is the bridge.
Yeah, we got so excited we have to have an encore right in the middle of our first episode together. And essentially what happened is I just got so excited, lost track of time as we were going through his great book here, A Time to Lead. So we were talking about resilience and everything. And what I'd like to do now, Craig, is kind of jump into the last skill, which is kind of how you anchor your book, which I think is important, which is fantastic. And it's around authentic leadership. So, Craig, what exactly does it mean to be an authentic leader or to lead authentically?
Well, and thank you. And it's awesome to be able to continue the conversation after our intermission. And this is really fun. And we talked about Al Mulally, the former CEO of Ford, Boeing, one of the most highly celebrated CEOs of all time. And the reason I reference him, he has given me the best definition of authentic leadership I've ever heard. It's phenomenal. And he says that authentic leadership is when your values, your beliefs, and your behaviors are in alignment. And then people can only see your behaviors and then make assumptions about what your values and beliefs are based on what they see and what they hear. And I'm like, okay, we don't have to talk anymore because that's just amazing. And what I love around that is that it provides such a powerful anchoring question whereby you start to think about what you're saying, what you're doing. And I have these conversations with CEOs and other executives I work with, is you start to think about, okay, what are the behaviors? What am I saying? What am I doing? And how's that like to be interpreted outside? Not what my intentions are. It's what are the people who are interacting with me likely to think about me in those moments?
I think that's so true. Because when I was reading that, I thought about, because you could really blow it. People could, you could come across as authentic, as genuine, and then you just lose your temper or whatever, and you act completely different. And regardless of what you say, you know, regardless of you saying, well, my intentions are good, people don't really care about that, right? They care, or they don't believe that. They go with what they see.
Absolutely. And you're touching on such an important point, Damon, that I love that you're opening the door for us to explore. Is that, Raul, you know, our intentions, regardless of where we're coming from, it's the impact that we have on others. And I also think what's great, too, about what you're talking about, that volatility, shall we say, that disconnection, the inconsistency, you reference resiliency. Well, authentic leadership is a superpower when it comes to navigating periods of disruption, during periods of challenge, during periods of chaos. Because, well, what is authentic leadership about? And you just touched on it. It's consistency, right?
100%.
And so one thing, that's the number one reason why it's so challenging for people during periods of disruption. Well, everything's uncertain. What happened during COVID? Everything that we thought up is down, down is up. And so I need to find a place where I can feel safe, secure. You hear this a lot. Psychological safety is another great example. Well, if I'm working with an executive, if I'm following a CEO who is authentic, well, now that gives me a safe harbor from all the other stuff that's going on, all the other things that are outside of my control. When I'm interacting with Damon, I know who he is, what he's about, what he values, what his beliefs are. And now because of that consistency, that provides that stability that I'm seeking. All right, let's go forward. And I know what to expect and what to anticipate so that now we can work together most effectively.
No, I love that. And a gentleman we've both had a great privilege to speak to and work with is Doug Conant. And he talks about first hour, first day, where he just gets crystal clear with, this is what you expect of me. This is what you're going to see. And I think that, Craig, I think that really helps with their employees and everything. One is like it lowers the anxiety in the sense that, okay, I know what I'm working with here, you know? And for a leader, you got to kind of live up to those standards after that, right? And that's kind of like what Doug said, once you put it out there.
Absolutely. And I think what's really interesting, and I love that you're referencing Doug, right, is that, well, because we live in ourselves so much all the time, we can almost assume that certain things are just so obvious, right? What we stand for and all those kinds of things. And I love that practice that you're talking about from Doug in terms of, well, imagine if we take that moment where we go, hey, you know what? Here's what you can expect from me. Here are my values. This is my leadership philosophy from day one, hour one, moment one. Well, now it just unlocks so much potential for us. It expedites the onboarding process, right? And I had the privilege to speak with Adam Bryant. So he wrote the corner office columns for the New York Times. As a similar idea, which I think is also so, so powerful, it's like sharing our user manuals with each other, right? You think about tech, the thing that we're supposed to do when we get new technology, although many of us don't, is look at the user manual. Well, we as human beings have a user manual. So, and that's what I love about what Doug is talking about, is that it's really highlighting who we are at our core as leaders, as human beings. And now that accelerates our opportunity to get to know one another. And now what does that do? Well, opens up the door for us now to get into the real work right away, right? So I don't have to be wondering about all these questions that are invariably going to pop up as we start our journey together.
I mean, it seems so simple, or, you know, so clear, but what are some of the particular challenges in leading authentically in a modern world like we're in today?
Yeah, I think, and it's a fantastic question, because I think one of the things that people struggle with is that, okay, there can be so much chaos, so much challenge around us, so much reactivity around us, we can feel the risk, right? And so I think a couple of key things here. Number one, for CEOs, senior executives in particular, we can't take stands on absolutely everything. So sometimes there's just this absolute just avalanche of what am I going to do here and here and here? And I think some of the most thoughtful discussions that I've had is around saying, okay, here are the five core anchors. Again, back to our values, right? And this is where we're going to make our stand, our perspective being known. Not that we don't welcome different perspectives and different points of view. These are the things we are going to intentionally stand for. And I think as well, sometimes it can be scary to not take a stand, be very clear on our values. Because what if someone, you know, doesn't align with that, or maybe someone has a challenge with it? And I love, to me, it's all back to framing, right? Reframing is such a powerful tool. And Alan Mulally is an example we talked about, right? Working together management system. Well, here are our values, our principles, and our practices. If they're not for you, you're still awesome. We love you anyways. And maybe there's a better place for you that's going to be much more aligned. And so in that way, now what happens is the individuals that you attract, the direction where you're going and how you get there, there's tremendous alignment around that. So as an organization, it's really going to put you in a position to be successful. So to me, doing that deeper work, as Doug talks about, another great quote that he shared is that it's hard to lead with the courage of your convictions if you have no idea what your convictions are. And I'm like, okay, that's just rock star. And once again, it's that true north, figuring that out. So doing that work internally is so, so important.
No, I think that that's critical, right? Because especially as you build and develop a team, or you already have a team, you want them to be aligned with what your visions and goals are and make sure that their purpose aligns with that. And by the way, if it doesn't, hey, no problem. You're a great person, but let's help you go find someplace else to go, right?
Absolutely. And what's also so cool about that, you talk about the challenges of onboarding top talent. Well, guess what's going to happen if there is a mismatch, let's say, right? And now you help someone find a better fit, a stronger cultural match for them. Talk about an amazing show of goodwill. Talk about an amazing focus on, well, we're all human beings, so if we disagree, that's okay. And also, hey, how strongly entrenched those values are. Because you hit on it earlier before, right? Inconsistency is a morale killer, a relationship killer, on and on and on and on. Because people are going, okay, today you said X, and now you said Y tomorrow. Who's the real you? So by drawing that line in the sand and saying, you know what? These values, who we are, influences our hiring practices, our promotion and rewards, right? It impacts where we're going as an organization. Well, now that just transcends everything and people go, yeah, I want to work there. Or, no, I don't. And again, that's great. Rather than waste people's time, our time and others' time, you know what? That's okay. No worries. So as an example, my book is called Do Good to Lead Well. My clients who aren't really particularly enthusiastic about positive psychology or positive leadership, probably, why do I care about empathy? That's a waste. Too soft. Excellent. Like, I would argue otherwise based on the evidence. That's totally cool. You want to run your organization? Fantastic. That's great. And now you don't have to waste time vetting me, and I don't have to kind of go, hey, bring you along to where I'm going.
I think that that's so important. And it really has to start in the interviewing process before the person, because you don't want to find out afterwards, right? So what is maybe one practical insight that leaders can do or hiring managers can do prior to bringing somebody on to make it really crystal clear, like, this is what we are, this is what we stand for?
Yeah, I think this is such an important point of conversation that we can have, and you nailed it, Damon, in terms of the interview process. Like, what better time to start exploring that? So a couple of things that I find are really valuable. Number one, asking each interviewee, what are their values right away, right in that process? And then also you can ask follow-up questions around, how do you live those values in your personal life? How do you lead those values in your professional life? This is really fantastic because asking for concrete examples, it's easy a lot of times to come up with a high-level answer using lots of fun labels, yet at the end of it, well, what does it really mean? What have you actually done? And this is, you know, lots of great research showing the best predictor of future performance is past performance, right? So let's figure out, so how do you do this in your day-to-day practice? And I think another piece that you can explore in through the interview practice is to say, okay, so have you looked at our values? Which of our values do you feel most closely aligns with who you are? Why is that? What are the values that we hold that you feel is least like you? If you had to rank our values, which one is at the bottom of the list? I tell you, from an interview standpoint, A, who went through the values, and B, it's going to be really interesting to learn, okay, what most closely aligns with you, as well as what least aligns with you. Again, just getting the thoughtfulness around it to see the extent to which they're really values oriented, because once again, to just come up with something on the fly is going to be pretty challenging.
I love that. That's gold. And what I really like what you said in there, Craig, which is so important, is not just giving a high level response, but have them tie it to a specific story. You know, even like, okay, so the value of empathy is important. Can you share with me a story where you've been empathetic to somebody? It really shows that puts the metal to the wheel, if you think about it, because they have to come up with something where they actually mean what they're saying.
Absolutely. And then you can ask all kinds of wonderful behaviorally based questions again, right? Like, can you give me some examples of where your empathy may have gotten in the way of making a difficult decision? What are some of the challenges that you find with being empathetic? Like, everything is, you know, it's balance, following Goldilocks, right? It's just right. And so all of these things are positive and can be positive and impactful. It's also good to understand, okay, let's break it down a little bit, right? Like, what do you find most challenging about being empathetic? So that's every single piece, every quality that we have can be explored at a deeper level. And I love that you're picking up on that and sharing that passion that I have, Damon, around, okay, let's make it concrete. Let's make it behaviorally based. Let's really get into it so that we're not lost in, you know, describe yourself as an executive. Well, I'm a strategic people-focused leader who maps out a compelling vision for the future and aligns all the key stakeholders. Who doesn't say that? Like, every single person, it's like a classic ChatGPT answer.
You stole my words out of my mouth. That's a ChatGPT answer.
and this was before ChatGPT, right? And then so, all right, you do a keyword search of resumes on LinkedIn and on and on and on. All of this stuff, yes, I'm not meaning to disparage the importance of being strategic. How are you strategic? What does that look like? How have you brought that skill set to an organization? What lessons have you learned? How have you expanded your perspective on what strategic means? How has your definition of strategic thinking evolved over time based on your experience? Like, this, as you can tell, we could have a boatload of fun just going through that one label. And so I think so often we just kind of go, oh, yeah, Craig said strategic, check mark. Well, Damon said people first, check mark. How reliable is that? Is this person really living, breathing those values? Again, we've talked affectionately about Doug Collier, right? As we've talked about before, clearly lives and breathes this stuff, right? Like every single moment. Alan Mulally as well, just is a rocking example of the Working Together management system. So that's what you're looking for in these vitally important conversations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think our listeners just got a masterclass on some interviewing techniques there. And whether it's empathy, strategy, you could insert any of those and go through the same questions. I have one more question about authentic leadership. But the one thing I want to point out for our listeners too is, don't just hear the word strategic and do a check mark, like confirmation bias, like, okay, you wanted them to say it, so they said it, right? So you got to go deep, like Craig's saying, and have them make it more concrete. One more question about authentic leadership. Craig, how can you ensure that leaders, their actions actually reflect their authentic self, particularly when it comes to making like a really difficult decision?
Yeah, brilliant. And I think for me, what's really vital is, and like so much, right, in life, and once again, back to the learn-it-all philosophy, get feedback, right? Ask for feedback. Ask people for their observations about how you've held a team meeting. You just talked about decisions. Hey, what are your thoughts about this decision? This is my thought process. What do you think? What haven't I thought about? When I made this decision, when I implemented this action, how did it go? What may have come across as counter to our values? Like all that kind of stuff. If I look at this through a values-based lens, what might I be missing? Just feedback, learn it all, open the door, get everyone around the table. Like this is not a time to be shy around these things, and do it early, do it in advance. Like writing a book, you know, we've both written books. What do you want to do? Get out to people and say, hey, I'd rather hear it from you than hear it from someone else. So let's go. Let's talk about what have I, you know, where's my thinking solid on this? Where do I really need to sit down and reevaluate my thought process around this topic or this issue? Let's have that discussion, because I'm only going to be better for it. Either I'm going to be able to really strengthen my convictions by going through the process and enjoying the challenge of thinking through and flipping my ideas around, or it's going to broaden my perspective and go, oh, wow, I just totally would have walked into this. Well, thanks so much, Damon. That's absolutely fantastic. I appreciate you saving me from that painful kind of encounter. And now let's figure out how to pivot.
No, I love it. You know, feedback is so important. And that kind of takes me to my last question I have for you. Your book came out in 2022. So it's been a couple years now. So looking back, is there anything you've changed your mind on or gained new perspectives on since you've published your book?
Yeah. The short answer is everything. Because I'm always learning and kind of open myself at the conversation. What I would say is that on my side, for me, the importance of authentic leadership and how that sits, it's interesting. At the time, I made the deliberate choice of keeping it at the end. And I may have mentioned, you know, my book post said, value in every page. And what I'm noticing is that now perhaps that may have even opened the book, right, in terms of the order of things. I think that's absolutely vitally important. And what I would also say is that difficult conversations are becoming more and more challenging. So if I were to go back, you know, and expand a chapter around that, it's kind of the intersection between the emotions and the difficult conversations, because that has gotten next level.
Yeah, and that's we didn't really dig too much into that, but that's one of the number one things that CEOs struggle with. Craig, this has been amazing. Just to kind of recap what we talked about, you know, we start off, we talked about positive leadership, you know, why it's important, how it inspires and helps align your team to bigger picture, you know, and then we get into your fabulous book again that I got right here, and it's all about self-mastery and self-leadership, you know, and really this, when we talked about the seven key skills that are really important and critical. And those skills, it starts with mindset and emotions. You know, with mindset, it's all about how you frame things. Do you look at it as a challenge or do you look at it as a problem? And then you have your emotions, which we talked about how they're great data points to help you understand where you're going and why that's so important. And then like we were just talking about how receiving feedback is like rocket fuel for your career if you really want to learn and grow. So, I mean, this has been amazing, Craig. Where can our listeners connect with you at?
Well, this has just been so much fun, Damon. Really have enjoyed it. And we've just, you know, scratching the surface on such important conversations. Love your passion and your preparedness for these discussions. Like, you know, going through clearly have gone through the book and everything else, which again just exemplifies the person you are and your passion for the learn it all philosophy. People can connect with me at craigdowden.com as well as on LinkedIn. And so I'd love to, if you want to reach out and connect with me, let me know that Damon sent you. And so I'd love to connect there. And also my Do Good to Lead Well podcast, which is on Spotify, Apple, and all other streaming platforms. So thank you so much, Damon. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to join you.
Thank you, Craig. And for our listeners, he kind of downplayed his podcast. His podcast is one of the best in the world, Do Good to Lead Well. It's my go-to. It's one of my top go-tos for leaderships, and Craig has great conversations. And listeners, I'd also challenge you, go out and get Craig's book. And one of the things I've done since I read it is I've actually looked at and thought about some of the things I learned and actually went and applied them. And there's so many great things that you could easily apply to it. So until next time, everybody, stay curious, keep learning, have a great day. See ya.